Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Good morning. Thanks again for joining us for Faith Radio Mornings on Faith Radio. I'm Paul Perreault, sitting in for the vacationing Peter Kapsner. Good to have you with me on this day before Thanksgiving. Maybe instead of going to work this morning, you're already working on the turkey. After all, you got to make sure you have that bird thawed out. Those frozen birds take a while. Now, if you ever checked with the Butterball Turkey Hotline, they'll always tell you the best thing to do, and they have the chart there of how many days. If you're doing the refrigerated method, there's two main methods for thawing out the bird. One is the refrigerator method, which I know takes up a lot of space in most refrigerators, which are already plugged full of other things, including the pies and other stuff. But yeah, you can do that method. It takes several days. You can do the cold water method in the sink, which is faster, more labor intensive. If you haven't actually started the refrigerated method like a couple of days ago, you're probably stuck doing the cold water in sink method, but even that takes some time and effort, and you got to change the water on a regular basis. After all, don't want any of those problems. Now, maybe this is your first year cooking too, and you're wondering, okay, Butterball Turkey Hotline. Yeah, that's still there. You can still call them. They also have a website, and this year they have something brand new. If you want to interact with the Butterball Turkey Hotline, you can ask Alexa. Yes, they now have an Alexa skill for your butterball turkey, well, your turkey cooking. You don't have to have a butterball turkey, but anyway, it's just a good service that they have. So anyway, something new this year as our technology continues to change. Well, hope you stay with us this morning. A lot of interesting topics coming our way. We'll be talking in just a few moments with Drew Griffin. Drew is from the magazine called Providence, a journal of Christianity and American foreign policy. And a lot of news coming up, especially in regard to the death of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist who was murdered. Boy, it was back October 2nd, and the implications that has had, because although not an American citizen, he was a resident, a legal resident of the U.S. and a journalist with the Washington Post, and the implications that might be huge. We'll be talking with Drew about that. Also, Justin Gibbity coming up. Justin is from the Ann campaign, and we're going to look back at the midterm elections. Plus, criminal justice reform has been in the news, and the Ann campaign, Justin, have been really, really big on that issue, getting, you know, trying to deal with that, because there does need to be reform. Plus, coming up late in the show, I hope you're with us in hour number two, a couple of pastors that I read about. It was interesting. There was an article that was in the AP talking about spiritual first responders, chaplains working with police, voluntary chaplains, helping to engage people who are drug addicts and helping them out, trying to offer the light of Christ in that situation. And so I gave one of the pastors a call, and well, there's more to the story, and I want to get into that. So we're going to be talking about that. That'll be in the second half of the second hour, so stay with us for that. Drew Griffin coming up in just a bit. Thank you again for tuning in to Faith Radio Mornings here on Faith Radio. Up music there for Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine. Hey, good morning, Drew.
Morning, Paul. How are you doing?
Doing okay. Hey, glad to have you along. I got a text from you or an email last night saying you're in the Central Time Zone, because usually you're Eastern Time Zone, right?
Yeah, usually I'm in New York. However, I'm visiting my wife's family in Springfield, Missouri for the holidays. So
right.
I am I'm in your time zone, in your world, man.
Welcome to the central world here. So, well,
yeah.
In spite of all that, hey, thank you for being willing to join us this morning. I know you're trying to spend time with family, but the news just keeps spinning. And the news around the death of Khashoggi, the Saudi mm-hmm. journalist, continues to here over a month and a half afterward, continues to dominate things. So can you give us the latest on the situation regarding Khashoggi?
Sure. Yeah, we've been covering this issue really from the beginning, and it has been something that we've really tried to focus on through podcasts and through articles at ProvidenceMag.com. And Jamal Khashoggi, as you mentioned before the break, on October 2nd, entered a Saudi consulate in Istanbul and never emerged out of that. And it has been determined through CIA investigations and through numerous investigations that he was most likely dismembered and removed in pieces from that consulate, and that that was done at the behest of Mohammed bin Salman, who's the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. And since the CIA has kind of released its latest report last week, assigning blame to Mohammed bin Salman as kind of the ultimate actor, the pressure has really ramped up on the United States, and specifically on President Trump, to denounce publicly Mohammed bin Salman and to maybe proceed with some sort of official reprimand or sanctions against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The United States has imposed sanctions on 17 members, or 15 members rather, of the, I guess you would call it the death squad, or the individuals that we believe were responsible for the killing of Khashoggi. And but the pressure is now on the United States and on President Trump to kind of officially denounce it and move ahead with maybe some official kind of sanctions. President Trump has been resistant to this. Just on Monday, he, in an interview, said that he was really unwilling to assign blame to Mohammed bin Salman, which really kind of contradicts his own, you know, CIA and what they say actually did happen. So there seems to be a slight disconnect between the U.S. intelligence community and the White House. And there could be a number of reasons for this, political reasons. Our relationship with Saudi Arabia has been close and has been close for many decades. It's been based on a number of mutually shared interests that we have with the country. But I think that and many critics and many people within the Congress and the intelligence community feel that there is a space and there is a need for the United States to forcefully react and to impose some level of official reprimand against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and especially Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
Okay, you mentioned President Trump, and yesterday he was addressing reporters about the matter, and, well, he again seemed to be dismissing the reports.
We're not going to give up hundreds of billions of dollars in orders and let Russia, China, and everybody else have them. It's all about, for me, very simple, it's America first.
So he's, again, it's not that he, I guess he's not really totally dismissing what the CIA is. It's almost like he's sidestepping. It's not important. He just doesn't want to deal with it because of the business issues and then also the political issues, global political issues.
Right. I mean, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is a consumer of, you know, American goods, especially American arms. And we have a number of arms sales that are pending with Saudi Arabia that go into the hundreds of billions of dollars. And so, yeah, President Trump seems to, and this seems to be the case kind of across the globe, be moving toward a more, instead of kind of a, I would say, a morally character kind of based or trying to find the word, you know, values kind of based engagement with other countries, that he's moving towards more of a transactional model, and where, you know, whatever is going on inside the country is kind of ancillary to the relationship that we have, whether it be economic or kind of official and trade with the country. And this is where I think the critics may kind of have a point here. The critics of President Trump saying that, you know, we are America first, that's great. You know, looking after American interests, that's great. But what exactly, you know, are those interests? Are they merely economic interests? Are they merely, you know, trade interests? No, there are moral interests here as well. And while the stability of Saudi Arabia is important for the region, the choice is not binary. It's not between all-out war and you know, heavy sanctions against the country and nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like there's – it's not as if, you know, we just do absolutely nothing and just say, oh, you know, whether he did it or not, doesn't matter. Or we engage in just all-out kind of, you know, economic war or you know, actual war, try and remove Mohammed bin Salman. Those aren't the two choices. There's a middle ground,
mm-hmm.
and the middle ground has been drawn out and illustrated by years of U.S. interaction in the region, which would include sanctions, official reprimands, pressure for Saudi Arabia to conform to international standards of moral and legal conduct that govern nations across the globe. So there is a role for the U.S. to play, and I don't think it's just a transactional role. I think that the U.S. has moral leadership that it has to impose and give an example for the rest of the country, for the rest of the nations in the world.
Yeah, we're speaking with Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine. And Drew, one thing I did notice, too, was some articles about how the Saudi royal family is handling this. I mean, even though it may seem, some people say our president's not taking it seriously, they're wrestling with it.
Yes. I mean, it's a what's been interesting about the rise of Mohammed bin Salman is that, you know, he's a 33, 34, maybe 35-year-old crown prince that King Salman, the king of Saudi Arabia, has chosen, which is the tribal tradition of the House of Saud, is that the king is the one who kind of chooses. It's not a lateral succession like in Great Britain, where, you know, it immediately passes from the first child. The king can decide who can replace him, and so he has decided on Mohammed bin Salman. But his full brother, King Salman's full brother, Prince Ahmed, is 76 years old. He would be the natural successor to King Salman, and that would be the more kind of traditional choice. And so the members of the royal family, House of Saud, is huge. It has literally hundreds of princes and thousands of members. And even when King Salman dies, and he's quite old at this point, even when he dies, the family has a council that basically has to approve of the ascendancy of Mohammed bin Salman. And so it remains unclear of whether or not that they would be willing to do that. And so, yeah, they're wrestling with this as well, because they don't want to destabilize their partnerships with other nations like the United States. And they want to foster a nation and an environment that can invite, you know, a corporate investment. They're trying to grow their economy. They're trying to bring Saudi Arabia kind of into the 21st century. And so if Mohammed bin Salman looks as if he's a threat to that vision and a threat to that plan, they may choose to try and do something about him.
Okay, Drew Griffin, our guest this morning here on Faith Radio Mornings. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about Saudi Arabia. Also, the situation with Asia Bibi, the mom in Pakistan who was imprisoned and was acquitted of crimes, but still, in a sense, in custody, and what is being done to help her out. We'll talk about that more in just a few minutes here on Faith Radio Mornings. Anyone after the hour, this is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Paul Perreault with Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine, a journal of Christianity and foreign policy, with us in this hour. And Drew, thanks again for joining us, son, even though you're with family down in Missouri. You said Springfield, right?
Yeah, my wife's family lives down here, and so we are visiting them for Thanksgiving.
Cool. Well, welcome to the Central Time Zone again from New York.
And, yeah, right.
And, well, you know, getting back to talking about Khashoggi and actually Mohammed bin Salman, you know, it was interesting because it seemed like previously, you know, people were praising him because he was moderating things in the country, allowing women to drive and or at least opening up ways for that to happen. And so there was that hope, and now things seem to be being side, you know, put aside by all this. As Christians, I mean, again, what do you find when you're trying, like you say, a journal of Christianity and American foreign policy? What would be the right action here? What would you wish the president to do?
Well, I think that part of the mission of the Journal of Provenance is to equip the American mind to engage the real world. And so what we're trying to do is to look at the world in reality, the way that it really is. And the fact is that there are a lot of really bad people, right, that the United States has to interact with. It would be great if we could only have partners and we could only have allies that were, squeaky clean and morally upright. But we live in a fallen world, and we have to recognize that. We have to recognize that we ourselves in the United States, are fallen and sinful and make mistakes. And we have to deal with a lot of actors in the world. We have to trade with them. We have to engage with them diplomatically, who also are very, complex and perhaps even morally troubling. But that does not mean, I think, that we, withdraw from the world or that we completely ignore them. We have to engage. And the goal here that I would want to see the president do is to, stand, clearly and strongly for the values and the characters that have defined the United States, the character of freedom, the character of justice, the values of liberty and the rule of law. These things are essential to international stability. And I think that making even statements saying that, this is what we stand for and this is, what we believe, and, countries with which we do business need to begin to align themselves to us, I think would be the least that he could do. And that doesn't mean that we, pull up shop. It doesn't mean that we stop engaging with these countries. Sometimes we have to engage with these countries. But the ultimate goal is not just engagement. And the ultimate goal is not just the transaction, whether it's trade or economic transactions. The ultimate goal, I think, of America, the purpose of America, is to be a beacon of these values for which we were founded, and to show that these values, is in the ways in which that they are consistent with kind of a Judeo-Christian understanding of our Creator God and the created order of things, that these values are essential for human flourishing and ultimately lead to the greatest human benefit. So we should stand for those values. We should advocate those values. Even to our, harshest enemies, but also the very morally kind of complex individuals that we have to engage with on the world stage, like Mohammed bin Salman. But if we fail to do that, then the question is, what is our purpose? Are we here just as an economic institution? Are we the World Bank that is merely just kind of engaging in a transactional relationship with other nations? And I think America should be more than that.
Okay. I want to switch gears and talk about Asia Bibi, which has been something in the news for a while. Actually, this morning, noticing a headline talking about Asia, and it seems she and her family are appealing to now Germany to give her whole family citizenship so they can start a new life, because she's still, even though she's no longer in prison in Pakistan, is basically held captive in Pakistan.
Right. So Asia Bibi was a Christian woman who 8 years ago was ordered in her little village to go get some water from a well, which she did. Her family was the only Christian family in this village. And as she was getting the water, she took a drink from the well that she was getting the water from. And this, of course, according to the villagers, was breaking Islamic law for a Christian to share utensils and kind of share water with a Muslim. And so she was imprisoned. She was spent 8 years on death row. Recently, the Pakistani Supreme Court overturned her conviction and freed her. But very much kind of freed her into an extremely hostile culture. The moment that she was freed and the moment that was announced, mobs of Islamic activists and Muslims began kind of roaming the streets and protesting, and activists began kind of fomenting outrage, and it forced Asia Bibi into basically house arrest. Her family is kind of held prisoner because they are in fear for their lives, truly, not from the Pakistani government at this point, but from just the Pakistani people. And she's been applying for asylum to various nations. She applied to Great Britain, which refused her, kind of for reasons passing understanding. And now she's seeking an avenue through into Germany. And we have an article at prominencemag.com written by one of our executive editors, Mark Levecki, basically calling upon the United States to offer asylum to her. That she is the test case, the prime kind of example of why asylum laws exist, is that, you know, people who are under religious persecution, especially, you know, Christians, from our standpoint, that are under religious persecution, should be able to find safe harbor and should be able to exercise a freedom of religion. That's what the United States kind of stands for. And so, we are advocating and we are hoping that the United States would just unilaterally offer her asylum to extricate her and her family from this horrible condition and kind of the house arrest in which they find themselves.
Yeah, I've actually been surprised that the United States hasn't so far, considering how many people
right.
here have been praying for her, very concerned about her, speaking up for her, that it hasn't happened yet. So very
right.
And actually, this has been hard on the Christians within Pakistan, the small Christian community, too, because the riots have been very threatening.
Yes, I've known missionaries that have been there that have had to flee the country since this has begun. That they are in, they are in kind of extreme danger because of this instability. And I think that, you know, there for Christians, we have to think that there's an evangelistic purpose behind caring for the persecuted church. That we have, we are calling, you know, Muslims, we're calling non-Christians out in the world to become a part of not just a church and not just some kind of organization, but a family. And when that family abroad faces persecution or faces difficulty, you know, they need to know that there is a family abroad. There are other people in the West. There are people in the United States that care about them, that want to see them relieved. And if we don't care about Christians being persecuted abroad, it's a very hard argument then when we do evangelism in the East, we do evangelism with non-Christians around the world. It's like, what are we calling them into? Are we calling them into, yeah, leave your family, leave your culture, leave everything that you've known. But when you become persecuted, you know, we're not going to do anything about it. And I think it's the role of the church to care about these things. And I think that it's our hope then and our prayer that the United States would be a vehicle for people, not only as Azabibi, but Christians facing religious persecution across the world, and especially in the Middle East, that the United States would be a vehicle for their relief. And it remains to be seen that, you know, whether or not the Trump administration is really going to stand behind some of the statements that they have made, saying that they are going to care more kind of about refugees and Christian refugees, because the numbers have not yet to bear that out. So hopefully Azabibi will be a test case or a good example for us to show to the world what our values are.
Definitely. Let's hope that. Hey, Drew, again, thanks for joining us, and hope you and your family have a great Thanksgiving. And thanks again for joining us on Faith Radio Mornings.
Thank you, Paul. You too. Take care.
Faith Radio continues in just a moment. 33 after the hour. Again, Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Paul Perreault, filling in for Peter Kapsner. And again, if you're heading out on the drive to see family, looks like at least much of the upper Midwest and even Hartford, although cold over in Hartford, it will be good travel conditions getting to Grandma's house. Well, in parts of the upper Midwest, especially come Saturday and Sunday, driving home may be an issue, especially down in Iowa, but keep an eye on the weather, obviously. We'll be back with more Faith Radio Mornings. Justin Gibney, my next guest here on Faith Radio.
It took men with a biblical worldview to create the freest, most prosperous nation in the history of the world. And it will take men and women with a biblical worldview to preserve and defend, and in some cases, restore these same liberties. This is Jim Garlow. Psalm 33:12 says, "Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord." Here's the Garlow paraphrase of that. If you want to see America thrive politically, morally, economically, or any other way, it will first need to apply spiritual truths from the Word of God. The Word of God is true and has the answers for a nation adrift in anti-biblical values. And I'm praying God raises up a bold, well-versed people who will proclaim biblical truth to power, taking captive every unbelieving thought and making it obedient to Christ, the source of all wisdom. Be well-versed at jimgarlow.com.
21 before the hour. This is Faith Radio Mornings on this day before Thanksgiving. And joining me in this segment of the show, Justin Gibney from the AM campaign. Hey, Justin, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Paul, how's it going? Mm-hmm. Happy to be here.
Well, glad to have you along. I'm sure you're quite busy getting ready for Thanksgiving, you and your family. Anything special on your Thanksgiving table that might be a little different from others?
Anything special? I don't know about special. Definitely have the turkey, greens, things of that nature, but I think we keep it pretty much in the middle of the road.
Okay. Because the reason I ask that is up here in the upper Midwest, one of the big things is green bean casserole. And then I saw this map somebody put up about different regions of the country have different side things they like to put on different sides. And mac and cheese, I guess, is really big down south. Do you do that?
Oh, certainly. Certainly.
That's so strange.
That's a staple.
But have you tried green bean casserole?
I have not and don't plan on it, to be honest. But more power to you. You
know. Oh, man, you don't know what you're missing.
I hear you.
Anyway, well, real quickly, you know, for those unfamiliar with the AN campaign, can you describe what the organization's all about?
Sure. The AN campaign is a Christian civic organization that's trying to get Christians to engage politics and culture differently. We think right now, unfortunately, that Christians are actually reflecting the divides in the world, those racial divides, but also sociopolitical divides. And so what we're calling Christians to do is put ideology aside to some extent and focus on shared Christian principles, which to us means that you will be about compassion and conviction. And that's really what the AND campaign stands for, compassion and conviction, rather than going all the way to the left and surrendering some of your convictions because the political left doesn't allow some convictions, or going all the way to the right and surrendering your compassion. We're saying that the gospel is both love and truth, compassion and conviction, and that we should go to the public square with both.
So there's a definite intentionality and really hunkering down on the essentials of the gospel in the midst of all this.
That's right.
Okay. Well, in the past election, we just got through a midterm election, and I'm wondering, because you've been politically active for a long time, what has been your assessment of what happened around the nation?
Well, two Tuesdays ago was a very good night for Democrats in a lot of ways. When you're talking about the House of Representatives federally, they did a pretty good job. They also turned over some state legislatures as well. So they had a pretty good night. When it comes to the Senate, a good night for the Republicans. They kept the Senate with strong numbers, gained a few seats. And so what you're seeing, you're going to see, is divided government, as if it wasn't already divided enough. But yeah, you're going to see, you know, the House really testing the president, probably having him cough up some documents that he might not have wanted to before. And so you'll see a stronger back and forth in that regard. But you're also seeing some realignment. You saw that what they call Henrys, you know, folks who are high earners, but not rich yet. These are young people who usually voted. These are people who usually voted Republican. A lot of them went over to the Democrat side, and some people are saying that they may not come back. But you also have some internal issues on the Democratic side as well, where you have Democratic Socialists and establishment Democrats really having some major issues. And the only reasons those issues haven't come and been a bigger deal is because of Trump, which is kind of keeping that coalition together. So a lot going on, and we'll see in the coming years how that works out.
Yeah, somebody was talking about how many of these new Democrats who are heading to the House from districts that did vote Republican in the past, they tend to be more moderate. I won't say establishment. They tend to be more moderate Democrats, more centrist, and there's going to be a lot of play on that issue in the House.
Yeah, there's going to be quite a lot of play. So as you already see, some of these Democrat Socialists are already challenging Nancy Pelosi. You know, they're challenging her as speaker. We'll see what happens with that. But they're coming in saying, look, we want things to change, and it's not good enough just to say how bad the Republicans are. We think things need to change within our party to make a difference, and it's going to be a battle.
Okay. Also, there are a lot of close races and even some that had to go into recounts or such. That brought up issues of ballot tampering and such, especially now you're in Georgia, in Atlanta, and you had the whole issue of the governor's race there. What are your thoughts on the issue of election tampering?
Yeah, so our gubernatorial race here in Georgia, was pretty polarized. You had Brian Kemp, who is the Secretary of State, running on the Republican side, excuse me. And then you had Stacey Abrams, who was the House Minority Leader on the Democrat side, really going and almost disagreeing on almost every issue. What became the biggest issue of the campaign was voter suppression. And so what happened is early on, Brian Kemp was called to step down as Secretary of State. I think I would have recommended that just to avoid all perception of any mishandling of votes or anything like that. He chose not to do that. There could be practical reasons or financial reasons for that. Who knows? And so during the campaign, that became a big issue. Any issue that came up when it came to voting was seen as something that was bad faith. And so voter suppression is still the charge down here. And although there was somewhat of a concession by Stacey Abrams, she still doesn't believe that Kemp won the election fairly. And that comes with all kinds of issues and our trust in democracy and so on.
So what are your thoughts personally on was there that voter suppression? I mean, you look at that, you look at what happened in Florida with some of those recounts and some of those counties that there were a lot of.
Yeah, well, it's hard to exactly say because, you know, I wasn't in all these counties to see exactly what was happening. But if we go back to when the Republicans in the Georgia House or in the Georgia legislature passed what they call the exact match law, which meant that you basically had to have an exact match of your name and all these other things in order to be registered to vote, or they would actually hold your registration. That becomes problematic because there was really no proof that that was needed. And so given the history of this country when it comes to voter disenfranchisement, if you're going to put a new law in like that, you need to show that it's needed. Otherwise, it seems like an attempt to keep more people from voting. If it's needed, nobody wants voter fraud. I hope not. If it's needed, then good. But you have to make that case a little better. I don't think the Republicans completely made that case. And so we started off on the wrong foot going into this type of election cycle. And so that's where we start at. I don't know that everything was handled properly, whether it was communications or just making sure that there was transparency. I do not personally think that we can say this was a stolen election. Just like I think you need proof to say that you need new laws, you need a lot of proof to say that something was stolen. Mm-hmm. And so I would not go that far, but we need to make sure that there's as much transparency as possible and that we're all putting trust in democracy over our political interests.
All right. Justin Gibney, our guest in this segment of the morning on Faith Radio Mornings here on Faith Radio. When we come back, criminal justice reform is big news again. Actually, maybe we should say finally. And we'll be talking with him about that in just a few moments here on Faith Radio Mornings. It's 11 before the hour. This is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Paul Perreault filling in for Peter Kapsner, and Justin Gibney is my guest. Hey, Justin, during the break, my producer and I were just commenting, boy, you have such a good voice. You should be in radio. But then again, you do a great podcast. Can you tell people about that podcast?
Well, thank you. Yeah, we do the Church Politics Podcast, where we try to provide political commentary from a Christian worldview. That's me and Michael Ware. Michael Ware was in the he worked for President Obama in his reelection, but also was on his faith outreach team. And so we go back and forth on a lot of different issues, really just trying to be as objective as possible, but make sure that we're emphasizing Christian principles rather than any ideological views.
Now, I've listened many times and I highly recommend it, even though now I come from a more, I guess, conservative leaning side and you guys more left leaning, but overall, I mean, the gospel is core to what you guys do, and so I really, really appreciate that. And it's good for people like me to see the other side honestly expressed. So thank you so much for what you do.
Yeah, no problem. Okay. Thanks for listening.
Real quickly, I want to get to the criminal justice reform issue, but also there's been one Senate seat that's kind of been hung up, as it were. It was a special election down in Mississippi. They had two, like Minnesota did, they had two Senate seats open. One was a special election, and the other one went fairly solidly for the Republican, but the other seat is in a runoff because neither major party candidate got the majority. Can you give us a summary of what's happening there and what are the issues that's delaying all this?
Yeah, so just in general, you have Mike Espy, who is the Democrat, running against Cindy Hyde-Smith, who is the Republican. They are in a runoff, and one of the things that's been going on is there's been some serious racial tension. Hyde-Smith was at an event where she was talking to a supporter and said something like, you know, I like him so much that I'd be in the front row at a public hanging if he asked me to. And given that this is in Mississippi, given the history of Mississippi and lynchings, it just was a very unfortunate comment. And now we see she's made more comments. She's seen and wearing garb, I guess, of the Confederacy and all this other stuff. And so it's really become a racially charged conversation down there, unfortunately, instead of being about policy and making the lives of Americans and Mississippians better. Now we're simply talking about just bad behavior and bad comments.
Any word on how, because they're doing, what is it, not next week, but the week following. Is that the special election?
Yes, I believe. Yeah, so I believe it's the week following. And yes, it will be a runoff. The tough thing is it's right after, I believe it's next Tuesday.
Oh, okay.
I think it's right after Thanksgiving. And that's really tough. I think for especially for Democrats, usually that's a tough time to do it right, to have a runoff right after Thanksgiving. But we'll we'll have to see how that ends up. But yes, very, very hard to get people out that soon after a holiday.
Yeah. Well, real quickly, we only have a few minutes left, but I want to talk about criminal justice reform, because just a couple of weeks ago, or about a week ago, the president putting his weight behind, I think it's called the First Steps Act, that the House passed back in May, which with broad bipartisan support. And now it's been stalled for a while in the Senate, although there's some work in the Senate to put their own version of it together. What's your assessment of the bill as you understand it?
Yeah, so the First Step Act is exactly what it says. It's the first step in kind of fixing some issues that we have in our criminal justice system. As you know, there are people, there is a disparity in our criminal justice system when it comes to race and other issues about how much time people are serving for certain issues. And so we know for years that people who had crack cocaine were charged, given higher sentences than people who had the powder, you know, and that's just, there was really no good justification for that. So one of the things that the First Step Act does is it gives people an opportunity to have their sentence reduced who are nonviolent drug offenders, which is about half of all the people in federal prison. And so that's a big deal. I think Christians should always be concerned about criminal justice, because the Bible is full of false imprisonment and all those kind of things. And it's a human dignity issue. If we're really about family, we should want people with their families. And that is not to say that people shouldn't serve the time for the crime they committed. That's not what this is about. But we always have to be conscious and making sure that the punishment fits the crime.
Right.
That's something we should always check on. And really, that's what this does. Tries to make sure that the punishment fits the crime. It also gives some money for job training, rehabilitation, things of that matter. All things that Christians should really think hard about, because we believe in redemption. We don't give up on people. And if we can give people a second chance and be merciful, then we should. Again, this has nothing to do with putting people back on the streets who shouldn't be on the streets. But we should always be looking for a chance to give people second chances when we have the opportunity. I think this does that. However, one thing we need to realize is it's not hugely impactful. And some of the people who have criticized it say it's just not enough, and it's not a comprehensive bill. The other thing we need to understand is that most people who are in prison are in state prisons. And so it's not going to have the huge effect that it would have when states actually do some criminal justice reform. So just some things to keep in mind. But the First Step Act is a first step that we should have taken a long time ago. This should be a no-brainer, because a lot of smart people have put time into this. It's bipartisan. Rarely do we have something that's bipartisan that gets this far. We need to make it happen.
Okay, so you're putting your weight behind it, your support behind it. But for future changes, I mean, we only have like a minute. I don't know if you can do it in a minute, but talking about how the church really should engage issues of restorative justice.
For one, just to be thoughtful about it, again, making sure that we understand the issues, we understand sentencing, we understand the disparities, and taking opportunity to say, do we have a chance to be merciful here without putting people in danger? We should always be looking for chances, for opportunities to be merciful.
Amen. Well, Justin Gibney has been our guest this morning on Faith Radio Mornings. Justin, I hope you and your family have a great Thanksgiving and hopefully a wonderful Christmas season, too.
Same to you, Paul. Thanks for the invitation.
This is Faith Radio Mornings. Back in a moment. Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Paul Perreault with filling in that is for Peter Kapsner. And, you know, looking forward to tomorrow. There's the turkey. There's the dressing. There's the Macy's Parade in the morning. And three football games. Yep, it's a triple header tomorrow. The NFC leading Bears, North leading Bears visit the Lions in Detroit. You have the East leading Redskins playing the Cowboys, and then the NFC South leading Saints seeking their 10th straight game. They'll be hosting the Falcons in the nightcap. So it is going to be, if you're into football, a very, very busy, busy day. If you're getting on the road, though, maybe that's what you're doing today, and you don't want to miss out on Faith Radio, just remember, you can always download the Faith Radio app. It's free at your Google Play or App Store. That way you're able to listen to Faith Radio live. There's lots of great articles and information on our website, and also podcasts. You can always check in on the podcast. Well, again, that's free. Just download it at your Google Play or Apple App Store, the Faith Radio app. Coming up in a few minutes, Bill English from Bible and Business joining us. Last week he missed out because there was a big best practices conference, and he's going to give us a recap of that. That and more coming your way in hour number two of Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Paul Perreault. Thanks for joining me. Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.